It might feel hard, it might be hard, but it's gonna be easier. And then one day, you notice, you get the alarm, okay, you get up, you don't even have to think about it, you just do it. One day, you don't even need to alarm anymore, because you have formed a habit and that's automatic.
Hier ist Christoph Maurer und du hörst 100%, den Podcast über Fokus bei der Arbeit, Achtsamkeit im Alltag und auch heute wieder über ganz grundsätzliche Fragen des Lebens. This is one of the new episodes that were recorded in English due to my interview partner being an international speaker and the researcher of the self. You are about to listen to Inka Land, Master of Science in Neuropsychology, podcaster, TEDx speaker, DNA coach and author. This talk covers epigenetics and consequences for upbringing, children, mental health and clarity, support through food and habits, and we have a quick look into some important neuroanatomical structures. We are discussing personality theories and their development through the last centuries. Thank you so much for listening. Have fun learning all this new and exciting and frontier-expanding stuff, and feel free to ask me anything that did not become clear in the next hour. This talk is a blast. I would mainly love to talk with you about, well, the neuropsychology of mental and personal development talk you did at the Biohacker Summit, because, well, I loved it. Well, so what you did with the social outlook, how different mental models or our idea, how is the human being, how they evolve over the centuries. So that is a really interesting thing. And also when I'm following you and Sim as well, and I see that you are so much walking the talk. So that's a really interesting thing, how you implement all the stuff you know into your development, and how you make a habit out of knowledge.
Mm. Well, thank you so much. I'm happy to hear that the talk was resonating. It's definitely a very fascinating topic, because it affects to all of us all the time. We are developing as a human beings every single day, every single moment, second. And we can control it to a certain extent as well, or choose how we grow. So I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'd love to deep dive into some of the points that you made in your talk. And one thing that was so interesting for me was that, well, there is the brain, and that looks quite similar between individuals, but then there come the connections, which result from our development and the environment we got, but also the bonding experience we do have. And there's a lot of, there are many little screws to fine-tune all this, but we don't know exactly where to go, do we?
Basically, yeah, we don't know what our connections look like. We cannot scan our brain, we can scan our brain, of course, but we cannot very everyday life. Like in the body, we can see in the mirror, oh, okay, there is a little bit more coming to this area and I'm getting a lot fitter in this area. It's very hard to see this in our own brain. What we can do only is to monitor our behaviors and monitor our feelings and emotions and mood. And then we can decide, what is the goal where I want to go? What is the goal where I want to develop? Let's say you are very reactive all the time, anger outburst or things like that. And you realize, this is not the state where I want to be. So now the one thing that you can do is to acknowledge that there is some brain basis all the time in our behavior, because brain pretty much creates on how we act. And then decide the goal. I want to be calmer, happier, more friendlier, more socially affiliated, and just a better person, I guess, would be. And you start thinking, how can I systematically change myself through my brain to make this happen? Because if you change yourself, you change your brain inevitably. And if you know a little bit about the brain, you can really high speed that development.
Okay. So you implemented the concept of multifinality versus equifinality.
Yes.
And that was really interesting for me to listen, because that opens a space of possibilities to really change what happens there. And to explain to people that multifinality means, as far as I understood, that we all have, for example, same resources, same setting in the beginning, but there's such a diversity in people when they are adult. And equifinality on the other side is, well, there could be people with completely different bodies or body composition or genes, but if they behave in the same way, they will end in the same state.
Mm. Yeah,
so that's openness.
Yeah, that's a very good summary of what it means. Multifinality and equifinality are used usually when we talk about genes and the outcomes of genetic makeup in the people. So when we are born, we have genes inherited from mother and father and the ancestral line, and then these genes are not defining our destiny. I actually just recently talked with Dr. Melissa Peterson, who is an epigenetic expert in this field. And she pointed out that actually from 70 to 95% of what defines, for example, our longevity, health, and disease risk is based on lifestyle, not genes. So this means you born with certain sets of genes. After that, majority of what happens to you as a person, how you grow personality-wise, health-wise, development-wise, is going to be defined by how you live your life. There can be two people who are born with the exact same genetic makeup. And now we talk about identical twins. One of them can become, for example, autistic in childhood, and the other doesn't, or in adulthood. So this is defined by lifestyle. There can also be two individuals that are born with very different genetic makeups, which both ends up, let's say, as autistic, or whatever the outcome is. So yes, definitely it's a lot about how you choose to live your life, and you have the possibilities to affect, even if there is a gene that has a disease risk. Let's say APOE4, we all have heard of it. Usually it's the gene that is most known to link to Alzheimer's disease. So people with APOE4 have a risk of getting Alzheimer's at a young age. However, it doesn't mean you actually get it. It just means that if you live high-stress lifestyle, eat a lot of saturated fat, don't sleep, and just don't be healthy or keep yourself healthy, you have an increased risk to getting it. So through our life, we modify our genes and how they turn on or off through epigenetic markers.
Yeah, that is... Well, it's quite a shift in paradigm. So when I started studying, the word epigenetic was not there yet. It came in the last years of me studying. And before that, there was the genes, and they were like your destiny. So there was some years before and said, now we can read your genes. Now we can do individualized medicine. But it is not. It did not happen, actually. In some oncology therapies, it did, but not for the broad public. Because obviously, it does not matter that much what is written in the book, but it matters how many pages do you read. So how often is the genetic code expressed into proteins? And this will result in different shapes of structure of the body and also of the brain, and then consequently in thoughts and behaviors and habits.
Yeah, and that's the most interesting thing, I think, what many people don't realize, or it's not even that talked, that it's not only that genes tell if you get a heart disease or cancer or Alzheimer's, or not even tell because they don't, but it's often talked in that context. But many people don't realize that you can actually change your genes to positively transform your personality as well. So it's estimated that there are over several hundred genes that affect on how we express our thoughts and behavior and habits, and 700 genes that affect how our nervous system is reactive, for example. So just like genes affect on your feelings of depression, anxiety, your feelings of motivation and drive, your feelings of goal setting, and sort of this kind of integrose action, things like that. And through epigenetics, we are able to kind of shift a little bit of our internal paradigms as well.
Yeah, it is impossible to imagine that one might pick one of the 700 genes and say, so this is the one, and I will make a one shot on this gene and make it strong, and then I'll be successful for anything. But yeah, you have to go into underlying mechanisms, some that promote positive activity of gene reading and gene expression.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, it's important to acknowledge that not a single gene defines anything. So it's always a complex, like a mixture of different type of genes mixed with your memories and emotions and how they all modulate each other.
In your talk, you asked a rhetoric question. Do our allelic variations make you a warrior or a worrier? I understood, no, it, definitely not. But what we feed to our allelic variations will do that.
So there is a gene called COMT, catechol all-metal transferase, which basically alters how your brain breaks down dopamine and noradrenaline. Dopamine is super important for motivation, drive, motivated action, but it's also linked to reward and addiction and things like that. So you kind of want to balance dopamine. Dopamine makes noradrenaline. So if you have a gene, this COMT allele, that is a little bit slower, then your breakdown of dopamine is not that efficient, and you actually have more dopamine circulating in your brain. So it's actually said that these individuals may be the worrier type, who get more stressed because noradrenaline is stress hormone. And the individuals who are able to break down dopamine faster are warriors, because they can handle a lot of stressors without getting alarmed by them. However, like, dopamine is also a motivator, a driver, and we need dopamine to make goals and execute goals. So it pretty much comes down to, you know, if you're a warrior or warrior, what are the attributes of these people? Well, they can be highly dopaminergic, but they're able to handle it. They're able to like have that stress resilience and direct that dopamine into, let's say, producing work or making life goal happens, rather than being super addiction driven or very worried. So in that sense, yeah, there are genes that take part of something that might be a risk or not. But it really comes down to how you have trained your belief systems and emotions and what you're going to do with that capacity of these genes working in a certain way in your body.
Yeah, sure. There is no safe life without fear. So we need this. We need the ability to fear stuff. But also there is no productive life with overwhelming fear. And then you will shut down all your motivation system. I guess it kind of is the shadow side of the archetypes that shows itself in those actions of the neurotransmitters in different situations. Maybe there's something like that. I'm exploring on that idea for some weeks now. And what you just said hits, very much into that same area. Because you said there's too much dopamine can lead to good things and bad things as well. It is your decisions, what you do with that energy. Same with norepinephrine, for example.
Mm. Yeah. And of course, it's like we don't want too much. But if you have, let's say, overactivated nervous system, then what you're going to do about it? Mm-hmm. Are you gonna like dwell over it that, oh my God, I'm so hyperactive and now I have all these worries, so I'm going to keep thinking about them and get even more stressed? Or are you, I have all this energy, I'm going to direct it to work, I'm going to go work out, and you know, you do something that's better coping, more adaptive mm-hmm. behavior at the moment.
Yeah, some conscious action on what evolution gave you.
Yes, exactly.
Your mama gave you.
yeah, you know, for sure. And this is what we, you know, many people think that they are sort of like trapped to their emotions or trapped to their nervous system state. If you are very worried, you can, like many people go locked and they go like, oh, I'm anxious and worried. How can I get out of this? Maybe instead you could think, oh, I'm anxious and worried. Okay, let's analyze what's going on in my nervous system. Okay, I have extra energy. I have these extra neurotransmitters. I probably have extra cortisol in my nervous system at the moment, in my body, circulating in my body. What can I do with this energy that will help me to get closer to what I want to be or what I want to do in my life? So you have cortisol, you have noradrenaline, you have dopamine. Go to the gym. Go for a run. Like, do something with that energy. It doesn't have to be all negative. It's not all black and white. And okay, so then there are people who during their lives have sort of developed this negative beliefs. So they are very alarmed all the time and their mind easily shifts into negative rumination, catastrophizing. And if you kind of miss this insight that, hey, I'm actually now shifting my own mind into negativity, it's way harder for you to come back. But when you start training this insight on your own thinking patterns that might be related to your childhood, might be related to your current life situation, whatever, you just come analytical of your mind through maybe meditation, journaling, or just introspection, sitting in silence and thinking what's going on in my mind and is this good or bad, is this adaptive or maladaptive, it becomes easier for you to use all of those states that you have in your body for adaptive functions and for growth.
Yeah, definitely. They do have a reason that they are there. And also rumination has a good base. It sometimes is the right thing to think over and once again and once again. But of course, if you don't get the strength into movement and into a concrete action, then it's for nothing, but only worries and will draw you down. But the idea of rumination, of thinking again and again, is not good or bad in the first place.
So basically, yes, you're right. Like the thoughts are just thoughts. However, we often get caught into our thoughts. And you may have an idea in your mind. It's some sort of a negative belief. Let's say I'm running out of time at work. It may not be harmful to you if you don't really care about that thought. But because with these thoughts, our self-processing areas activate, it actually starts feeling like I am running out of time of work. So it's like it becomes you, the worry. So we process our minds through our self-perception. There are different areas that may activate with the self-processing areas. But when you start linking that too much into you as a person, then it becomes usually maladaptive. Or if you cannot make a plan, if you keep yourself in that thought loop, I'm running out of time at work, but it doesn't take you anywhere, then it becomes stressful. It becomes repetitive, catastrophizing thought. So there are a few ways of get out from that loop. And one is really to practice mindfulness meditation, in which you acknowledge that I have a thought here. I have a thought here, but I don't have to become overly reactive about it. It might tell me a very important message. I'm running out of time of work. Maybe I actually have too long to-do list. Maybe I actually don't have time to do all of the things. But what am I going to do with that thought? So mindfulness meditation takes you out from that place where you just repeat the thought and takes you into a place where you can sort of observe the thought from an outsider perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see the thought from an outsider perspective, it's sort of like talking to a friend. Your friend tells you, I'm running out of time, so what do? You say, okay, well, can you maybe reduce your to-do list? Could you delegate some of your tasks? Could you ask help? So you get into more productive mode right at this instant. There is another way, which is called cognitive distancing, which also helps to kind of take the mind off from the repetitive loop, which is, and analyze the mind, which is that you say to yourself, I am acknowledging that my mind is now having a thought of X. I am running out of time. So I am noticing that my mind, these two entities are different in this sentence. So that's a sentence that makes our mind more analytical of our thoughts instead of just being caught in the thought.
Yeah. And you distance from thought, and thus it is not part of your identity anymore.
Yes, exactly.
And that is an important thing because it lets you take a deep breath for the first time. And then you can sort things out. You just mentioned the childhood as being, well, kind of a crucial phase in life where ways are set. And you said there's the caregiver is the programmer of the child's brain. I love the picture. What you told us is through experience and environment and attachment and nutrients. And all these things get on so many levels of the later human being, now the child, to be programmed. What can we do to support children to develop the best self they can do in means of, well, a cognitive and social and emotional equilibrium, maybe is the word.
Good word, very good word. And I love that question because this is very important. Let me just first say that in this space of personal development, we think, or many people are focused on themselves. Adults, unfortunately, we have so much stiffness in our brain already because to our life, let's say we have maybe repeated a habit or a thinking model for 20 years. And whereas we can change this, it's important to remember we can change this. What we can do to our children is like there is a huge difference on how effective interventions to children can be compared to adults. And that is because the neural pathways, these networks that we talked about, and belief systems and models are developing in the childhood. Child brain is also very sensitive to epigenetic changes, so to altering the gene activations. There are so many things that we can do to our children. And if we can increase this awareness, collectively be more developing to our children, then we can really create a very nice future for future generations, a very nice society and global shifts, I hope. So there are a few key things. First, it's good to acknowledge that what is like a child, it's a developing human being whose brain is like a high-speed developmental mode. Every day they cannot, when children are born, they cannot yet do anything themselves. So the adult, the caregiver, is all the time with them. And the adult provides them sensory experiences, touch experiences, sound experiences, the things that they see. So just environmental enrichment is first very simple thing that we can do to developing child brain. Exposing them to different languages, exposing them to different colors, different objects, different touch experiences. And especially this touch seems to be important for a child. Because, so we, now we go into attachment. Attachment is, it means that when the child is in stress, crying, or having needs, there is a caregiver who will comfort them. If they lack this touch and this comfort, their nervous system may develop to be overreactive or hyperreactive. They develop a sense of fear towards the world because they have learned that if I'm under stress, if I'm crying, if I'm hungry, if I have needs, there is no help. Because child cannot help themselves. They cannot walk into a fridge and take the food. It needs to be the adult who is there. If there is a loud noise and the child doesn't know where it comes from, they cannot introspect and self-explain to themselves, oh, it was just the dog barking outside. It has to be the adult who comes there, hold them and tell them, it's okay, it's just a dog, there is nothing to be afraid of, maybe you go and see the dog, and the child learns, oh, this is actually all okay. But if you never teach those things to the child, and if you never give that touch and that care, they never learn that the world can be actually safe, and they can be actually comforted in time of distress. This may lead into a situation where people become too pessimistic or too careful, too sensitive about everything in the world.
So, like a constant over arousal.
Yeah, constant over arousal and constant fear.
Yeah.
Because if as a child you have had experiences that, I don't know what could be a good example here, but you try something or you go into a new place. Let's say you go into a new place and you get a bit scared. You can go into a dark place, like it's a evening, and you get a bit scared. And then the adult can come and comfort them and say that, hey, it's okay, there is nothing to be afraid of. It's just that there is no sunlight at the moment. We can take a flashlight. So now the child learned that it's actually okay to walk, you know, in dark street if you have flashlight or you know, this kind of simple example. But then as an adult, if you never learn this, you never leave your home.
Yeah,
of course, this is a very extreme example, but you understand the metaphor here.
Yeah, the metaphor. Yeah, the metaphor is great because it's exactly that. We fear the dark, and also we fear the darkness of our soul. Where are the anxiety or where are our horrors that we try to push away in broad daylight? And it's easy to push our fears away in broad daylight. But when sun goes down and we feel alone, how can we self-regulate? Where do we find the flashlight in our life? And that exactly is what you talked about. These are the habits.
Yeah.
So and to form a habit is a conscious decision. So you do a goal setting. For example, I don't want to live in fear all day. And that this is a very important thing because there are recently great papers on showing for fathers, especially, that the moment or, well, the identity change to become a father can be seen in structural changes in the brain. So becoming a first-time dad is the most important impulse for neuroplasticity in the adult male brain. That is awesome. That is a big chance to develop. And I work a lot with fathers in my practice, and some of them come to to change to the better option of themselves because they want their children to have the best father they can. They would not take care of themselves for themselves, but they would do because they see the kids would benefit from the best father self that they could provide. And that then gives the idea to improve and to develop.
Yeah, definitely.
So how do you start unlocking and rewiring?
That's a good question. So unlocking and rewiring, what we mean by this is that if you are caught into a habit and you repeat your actions, which you may see that this is actually not adaptive, this is not something that I want to do. And let's say you are working 8 hours a day without taking breaks. And it's just what you have used to been doing. You've always done that. But you just start noticing that I'm getting aches and pain and stress. But it's so hard to change because I've always done this. So how can I change? How can I unlock these automatic behaviors that I have and rewire my brain to develop better habits? Habits form through repetition. So similar way that you formed a habit, you will unform it and reform it. You need to, let's say maybe when you started working, it was first very hard to sit still for 8 hours. Let's say you are a college student, you have used to going out, you have used to having one class here, other class there, going for walks in between, maybe to a gym, maybe to shopping, to eat. And now you have to sit in the office for 8 hours a day. It's so difficult at the beginning. You just like have to kind of push yourself because your boss says so, because the monetary needs say so. So you push yourself. But then over time, it becomes easier, easier, easier. You get used to it, and that's going to become your comfort zone now. So the same way, maybe you want to develop a habit that every hour I will exercise my body for 5 minutes. I will stretch, I will go out, I will see the sun, I will do a little bit of yoga just to keep my joints and muscles healthy. So every hour you set a reminder that now is the time to stretch my body. And you get the reminder and you're like, I'm in the middle of this task and I really want to push through it and I really don't have time for this break. You need to take the control and acknowledge that it's going to be hard at the beginning, but you're going to learn it. You're definitely going to learn it. It's shown that you can form a habit as soon as within 2 weeks. Sometimes it takes 60 days. Sometimes it takes 30 days, but you can form a habit very soon. And every time you get the alarm, the only thing you need to know is that it might feel hard. It might be hard. But it's gonna be easier. And then one day you notice you get to alarm. Okay, you get up. You don't even have to think about it. You just do it. One day you don't even need to alarm anymore because you have formed a habit and that's automatic.
Yeah, and reconnected to your body wisdom. Because a body will then connect with his needs and will express them. Yes. And you don't have to deny them and run away from your body needs and cope dysfunctionally.
Yeah. And what happens when you do this, when you start doing this, is that you start reforming your brain networks. So this alarm that you set to your phone is actually going to already activate your motor networks in the body. It's going to already make you want to automatically move your body, which is great because then you don't have to think or push and that feels more natural to you. So this movement then becomes your comfort zone. One thing that you can do to reinforce this or improve this or make it easier is that you set something that we called SMART goals. And SMART is an acronym. It comes for specific, measurable, achievable, time specific, and the R was okay. You can look it up. I should know it
as well, but I don't.
Yeah, the idea is very simple. You don't have to know all these words. What the SMART goals idea is that you make it so specific that you can really know what you need to do, when you need to do, and how much you need to do, and when do you need to have the goal like achieved. Let's say you say yourself, in 1 month, I want to have had develop a habit in which I exercise every hour for 5 minutes during my workday. So your action plan...
As compared to, I might have to move more, which would not be smart.
Yeah, I should move every now and then when I work. That's not a smart goal.
No, it isn't.
And then smart goal is something that you will make an actual action plan. So it's like every hour, or let's say twice a day at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., I will move my body for 5 minutes. So that's a smart goal. But tomorrow I'll move a bit more. That's not a smart goal. And one thing that you can do after the SMART goal, which makes SMART goal even easier, is you do an if-then plan. So if-then plan means that, you know, you may have had a SMART goal. Every morning, I walk 20 minutes after I've had my morning cup of coffee. But then next morning, you wake up and it rains. So what do you do? Ah, well, it's raining. I'll do it tomorrow, you know. So you immediately bombard your habit. Now you need to have if-then goal for this situation. If it rains, then I'll do 20 minutes of yoga. So think all of the things that might come as an obstacle for your habit and prepare for them.
Yeah, because your mind will create them. Your mind will blow up the obstacles to just rest in his comfort zone.
Yes. So let's say your goal was to move 5 minutes every hour during your working day. And then you are in the middle of writing an email. So if I'm in the middle of writing an email, I will stop the writing, I will move, and I will return it later. If I'm in the middle of phone call, I'll have my Bluetooth speakers next to me, I'll put them in my ears, and I do squats while I'm on the phone. Anything that may come up and bombard your habit. Because yeah, we are very, very good at making excuses.
Mm. Are there any means, any habits that we could implement to improve our ability to learn those new habits? So is there some self-fulfilling, self-activating habit to implement?
Yeah, like a meta skill.
Yeah, something like that.
Mm.
On the physical level. So like, I know that for hippocampal activation, sleep is of importance.
Mm.
So, something like that. So maybe our everyday schedule will destroy our SMART goals if we don't support the neural. The hippocampus is for everybody who didn't study this neural stuff so deep as you did, but the hippocampus is an important structure that is for the consolidation of short-term memory into long-term memory. So it's very much what is from the RAM into the hard drive in a computer language, so to speak. So it is crucial to activate if we want to remember things better, but also if we want to deepen habits.
Yeah, that's a very well explained hippocampus, by the way. I love the REM hard drive, or like REM hard drive metaphor. So yeah, hippocampus, a very good point. So we can strengthen the habit formation. I think two ways are important. So let's first talk about the hippocampus. Hippocampus is a structure that's in the middle of your brain. And every time you learn new information or do new habits or encounter, basically live your life, the hippocampus is activated and you process it in your conscious mind, right? You're like, let's say you're reading a new fact. Oh, hippocampus is the brain structure related to memory. So now it's in your prefrontal cortex, but also hippocampus is active. And now it's sort of like transferring this information into the cortex. But this transferring does not happen at the same time. The transferring of the information needs to activate later when the hippocampus is at rest. Restful moments are relaxation, but sleep is the most potent one. Sleep is when the hippocampus is actually, we think like when we are at sleep, nothing's happening inside our brain or mind. But meanwhile, our conscious mind is off. Our brain is actually doing so many things. That's the most active time of the brain. So it's detoxing from beta amyloid and stuff. But one of the key things that's happening is that hippocampus is actually rewiring those same rewinding and playing again those same memories that you play throughout the day. So there are actually studies in which they have looked, these are done in animals. So they looked at individual neuron firing in a rat's brain when they do a task. So in the day, it's going like tick, 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 this neuron. And in the night, they measure the same neuron. It activates exactly at the same pattern, but in a fast speed. So like tick, 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 or trrr. So it's like all the time repeating those memories. So we really want that process to happen, otherwise we will forget. There is, you can have 80% better memory after having this hippocampal activation during sleep compared to if you are sleep deprived. You will also have better learning capacity at the next day if you sleep compared to if you didn't sleep, because you basically didn't, I would say maybe you didn't move those memories from the RAM into the hard drive. So now the RAM is full and you cannot insert new information before you transfer the information to the hard drive.
Buffer overrun. Yeah.
So we really want that sleep to happen. Another thing that's shown to activate hippocampus is meditation. And if you notice you have a lack of sleep, you don't have time to meditate, then I would say that, because meditation can be hard, it can be difficult for people, and some people don't relax during meditation for sure, because they are too analytical of if it's working, are they doing it correctly. But one thing that you cannot not do correctly is progressive muscle relaxation, in which you lie on the floor, you squeeze some muscle group very tightly for a few seconds, and you just relax it. And you go through your whole body with this. And this is a very effective way of relaxing the whole body. And it can be like even a mini nap, like comparable to relaxing effect, even if you are not actually sleeping.
Yeah, that is what I do each day for years now. And I do have a certain pattern of breathing and focus very much on, I call it the good shit in, bullshit out exercise. Because I feel like through my hands all the stuff that crumbles my mind gets out of me. Then I feel almost every time I feel my hands getting warm, and this is the bullshit out. And that is something I do after, in between sessions with patients sometimes if I got the time, so that their stuff does not clutter my mind that much. But each time when I stop working and go back to the family, there is one of those sessions in between. And it's as short as 12 minutes. That is completely sufficient for me now, after some years of practice.
Yeah, definitely. It doesn't have to be long. So we can really, like, there are studies that show that even 5 minutes, 3 minutes meditation can pretty effectively increase the relaxation of the nervous system.
Yeah.
But I would say that, you know, start practicing these methods and you can develop your skill. It's kind of like, you know, when you go to the gym and you start lifting the first time, it might be a little bit awkward and hard, but soon you're just gonna go and do it and it's fast and easy for you. So similar with the meditation or relaxation, it might be very difficult at the beginning, but it's a skill that you can develop by rewiring your brain.
Yes. And also, as not each training session feels like the last one, and some feel better, some feel worse, but you did. And that is the same with those naps. So sometimes I don't fall asleep and sometimes I do, but each time I feel better than before.
Yeah.
No matter how it was in detail.
Yes, which is kind of how to trust that it works.
Yeah. And if you trust, then repetition will show the results. And then it works. With trust comes the work. Yeah.
Exactly. With meditation, with relaxation techniques. It's like you're probably not going to feel like a huge result, noticeable result in your mind or body immediately. But over time, it accumulates. And yeah, again, similar to the gym exercise. If you go once, you cannot see your abs growing, but you do it every day consistently and you start noticing those little lines at some point, like, oh, actually it's working, you know. So it's the same thing with mental exercises. They are just very, yeah, they are very beneficial for so many things.
Mm. There's, well, we as a society think about ourselves and our mind and our mental models, well, roughly spoken, like 100 years and a little plus, so with Freud starting to analyze the psyche. Mm. And but that is a completely different model of the mind as that what you now explain. Because what you now said, that is very much in feedback loops, and we can intervene by ourselves. We don't need another one to analyze with complex thoughts, but we can do immediate action and we can feel with the body what the mind will change. So that is a completely different model of the world and also the model of the individual mind. How come that both are right? Freud was right at his time, and in the meantime, there were others right as well. And obviously, we are right now as well when we consider ourselves not slaves of our destiny, but masters of our future.
Wow, that was a very nicely put phrase.
Yeah, I didn't know where that came from.
Yeah. You need to write that down somewhere. That's very powerful. So, Freud... I'm not possibly the best person to talk about Freud. It's a little bit like a dividing topic. Many people like Freud's idea and thinks that they're very impactful. Freud at his time was very, as you said, he was right. And he definitely ramped up the speed in which psychology developed. He was very influential to start, you know, bringing awareness of psychology, developing, even like contributed to the development of the university programs with Wilhelm Wundt and people like this. However, like his research methods are not anywhere comparable to today's methods, where we have controlled clinical research trials, we have brain imaging techniques, we have technologies that like biosensors and things like that. So Freud, his theories were mainly based on introspection and his own clinical population that he studied. And he developed a certain type of theory, which was that our development and personality are driven by sexual or aggressive tendencies or wishes, our unconscious mind. So Freud was right. Unconscious really drives our behavior a lot. What I don't agree with Freud is that everything is sexual or aggressive. And I think many people wouldn't agree with that one anymore. So it was something that he probably noticed a lot in his patients, which were this Austrian women, a group of Austrian women that he mainly worked with.
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is that it wasn't like looking at the population. He didn't make clinical experiments. It was his interpretation of what he saw in his patients. And we all have our subjective lenses through which we look at people.
Yeah.
So... whereas like his influence on just bringing the awareness about the unconscious mind was phenomenal, and we need to give him a lot of respect on that. I wouldn't go too much into analyzing your mind through like, okay, which sexual or aggressive behavior is now driving me, because this, I think, does not have any scientific basis whatsoever. But as a history of psychology, Freud was an interesting character, of course. Then we went into a big developmental waves in psychology, from basically this kind of gestalt psychology to we went to cognitive science, which was more mathematical, more computational. We went to humanistic psychology, where we were looking at the positive sides of people, how people can grow. And now we are sort of somewhere in like a cybernetics world where we look at all of the things combined together. So we are all the time right on what we know so far, but we are also all the time wrong, because we get new information all the time. And we just have to be, like ourselves and our personal development, we need to be open up of what's coming in the future, what new insights we will have. We need to be open in science to that one as well. And there is one thing that I want to point out in the psychological science and research, is that it's pretty restricted on what we can do in psychology because of the ethical things. Like, we cannot put people into bad places anymore. Like, in the past, we were able to conduct pretty, I would say, concerning experiments as well with the human psyche. Now we can't, which is a good thing. It protects people's mental well-being, but it also limits on what we can know about human mind. The second thing is that if something is not researched yet, it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. So now, for example, we have a lot of new information about spiritual beliefs or unity, consciousness, even these kind of concepts or ideas like transcendence and self-actualization and dimensional thinking. We haven't really researched those things as much. And many people may say like, well, it's not real because there is no evidence. But the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. If something has not been researched, it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. But we just don't know the truth that well. So we are all the time right and wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And we need to develop as a scientific community, but also as a spiritual community, the means to look at that. If we don't have the tools to detect, we won't detect. And this will go step by step. Is that what you mean with neural coupling? This connection in between people that now needs to be looked at?
Yeah, so basically there can be two people who are, let's say, well, the simplest way to say is if I smile, your brain areas...
I will as well.
You smile, you will smile, because your brain detects that and the same brain networks will activate. So you can make people smile or people happier by smiling. Because brain is interpreting signals around you. If you constantly look at negative news, grumpy people, smoking, whatever, you're going to start behaving that way because your brain is basically activating in these pathways. So I talked about neural coupling because I think it's important to realize that what you are doing to yourself and how you are developing as a person is affecting to people around you all the time and is affecting the state of the world. If you're constantly mad about how everyone is so negative these days and, you know, how everything is bad around me and how world is like a shitty place, then start from yourself. Because when you can become a bit more mindful of your own negativity, of your own facial expressions, or how much are you kind to people, or how you behave to people, then this will have a ripple effect of the world. So it could go like this. I smile, you smile, you go to the street, you smile to someone else, they smile, they are happier, they go to their workplace, they have this smile on their face, they smile to their colleagues. And this starts kind of like rippling and creating a big butterfly effect around us.
Yeah, and it's a conscious decision again.
Yes, it's we are driven by also what we see in our environment. So we may not notice that something is causing us bad mood that we see in the environment. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like this, it's called priming. So you see something, even a flash of like angry face, and you start feeling tense and you don't really know why. So the key here is that we need to analyze our minds quite often. And if we are tense, not maybe you don't have to, you know, just be the victim of all the states that your body have. Maybe you can acknowledge that, ooh, I'm noticing that my mind is feeling tense. Maybe I'll just smile instead and let that be there. And I'm sure it'll actually go away pretty soon when you consciously change it.
Yeah, that is of great value. Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to analyze everything until the end. You just can take action to reverse the mood.
Yeah, yeah. And with this, I also want to say that you don't have to get rid of all the moods and emotions. As you said previously, I think that was an excellent point, that emotions serve a purpose. So I think we are kind of, there is this movement in which it's like, get rid of your depression, get rid of your anxiety, get rid of your anger, get rid of this and that. What do we do if we don't have emotions as information? It's more about what you do with the emotion, not that you shouldn't have any negative emotions. They can have a very, very big impact on your coping behavior. Mm. So let's say, and sorry if this is a sensitive topic, for some, but let's say if your relative dies, but this is life. This happens to most of us during our lives. It would make no sense that you feel no sadness. It would make no sense to start thinking, how can I get rid of this depression and sadness? It's more like, I'm sad. I'm noticing that my mind is sad. So maybe I need to take a break, and maybe I need to work on this situation and take time to overcome it. Not like, how can I push this emotion away and smile to everyone that I see on the street?
That would be toxic.
Yeah, exactly.
To yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's more about, you know, if you're sad in that situation, it's also not adaptive to stay in bed and do nothing and just dwell on the emotion and go like, why did it happen to me? And, you know, it's more important to listen to it. Okay, I'm sad. I need to work on this. And then I need to, at some point, I need to come to peace with it. So it's information, and you can decide again what you do about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, especially grief is kind of the guardian of the memory. So If you don't allow yourself to let go, then the grief will deepen. But it's an important task in life that we have to learn that we let go. And also that we live in a mortal body. That is of greatest importance to realize, because if we were immortal, if there were infinite days, there would be no value in love, because it would inflate. And actually, I think that love is the most important emotional feeling and coupling feeling and bonding feeling that we can experience as human beings. But it would not emerge if we would live eternally. But it can only emerge if we realize that we are in a mortal body of flesh and that our days are counted. And that makes the moment so invaluable, important.
You know, that's so true. And Stoics really emphasized on thinking about your mortality often.
Yeah, microdosing death it is.
Microdosing death.
If you think each day about your mortal end, then you're microdosing death. And I think that emerges your ability to love.
Yes, yes. That's very well put. Microdosing death. Yeah, I mean, that can be very, very positive to your own mental well-being and health. There are even these systematic practices of thinking about mortality and death, they don't make people feel sad. They make people feel free. They usually make people feel less distressed about minor things in life and more loving and more appreciative towards their family and friends. So yeah, microdose to death.
Love it. I so much enjoyed talking to you, that we spanned a broad spectrum of ideas. And I guess what people can take from there is that you've got in your hands, it's a conscious decision to improve your life to the goals you want. And then it's what just doing, and that we can trust the process of doing, and that will improve to whatever way there lies in front of us.
Yeah, that's very well put.
Thank you very much for your time, and thank you very much for your work. I will put the ways how people may contact you into the show notes, and I would love people to contact you, because I did enjoy it that much.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed this, and it was a great honor to be in this podcast with you today. So thank you so much. I mean, it's such a fascinating topic, and there is so much to discuss. I think we could have gone for hours on these topics. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much. So let me wrap up what I called this show is a blast in the beginning. And there are three most important take-home messages to me. If you see thought from an outsider perspective, it is like talking to a friend. The caregiver is the programmer of the child's brain. And third is, you're not a slave of your destiny, but a master of your future. And I need to work on that one. You will find links in the show notes that lead you to the website of Inka, but also to her presence on YouTube and Instagram. Also, the link to her podcast, Mind and Psychology, on Apple and on Spotify, and be sure to check that one out. The R in the SMART acronym stands for reasonable. Yeah, no wonder I did not remember that one. Recently, I recorded some episodes in English, and if you're an English-speaking listener, save the show in your podcast app and come back for more. If you like this conversation, thought about someone specifically while listening, send them the link to the show and slap the like button here. If there are any questions left for you right now, write an email to podcast@christophmauer.de or voicemail on speakpipe.com. Christoph Mauer, for now, have a good day, eyes off the screen, and take care.